The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated June 7/June 14, 2021. It's titled The Great Reopening in black lettering above the large white block letter spelling Time. It says, "Will return," and it's a fake clock like one might see hung in a store window or on a storefront when the occupants have gone to lunch or gone home for the day. "Will return already here. Please get me out of the house. Is everyone vaccinated? When my kids are back in school with my pandemic puppy, wearing sweatpants 3 days a week. When my boss does, are you paying for child care? When I feel valued, yes, but in a new career, how about never?" Turning now to some of the print copy found within this edition of Time. Under the brief news, business. May 22, the family behind Charlie Bit My Finger, one of YouTube's most popular videos, sold their 2007 footage for nearly $800,000 as a non-fungible token, or NFT, and now plans to remove it from YouTube. The auction followed a number of other internet-famous faces cashing in on their memes' popularity. Raisa Bruner writes this short column. Disaster girl Zoe Roth became a popular meme, that's M-E-M-E, in 2007 after a childhood photo of her posing with a devilish smile in front of a burning house went viral. Many on social media have since used the image to share feelings of schadenfreude. Roth sold the image for nearly $500,000 in April. Bad luck brain. Kyle Craven gained internet notoriety in 2012 when a friend uploaded a not-so-flattering school photo to Reddit. That's R-E-D-D-I-T. It has since become a classic cringe meme used to express feeling awkward or embarrassed. Craven auctioned it as an NFT for about $36,000 in March. Overly attached girlfriend. Laina Morris sold a viral photo of her wide-eyed, manic-grinning face, invoked to illustrate overzealous enthusiasm, for over $400,000 in April to a Dubai-based collector who also purchased Disaster Girl and the Charlie Bit My Finger video. Good question. Why are Taiwan's COVID-19 defenses failing now? All it took to break down the world's most vaunted COVID-19 defense was a little tea. After almost 18 months of nearly unblemished pandemic success, Taiwan is in the grip of its first major COVID-19 surge. Total cases more than tripled in a little over a week to more than 6,100 as of May 26. Many offices sent workers home. The streets of the capital, Taipei, cleared out, and the government began scrambling to secure vaccines and improve one of the worst inoculation rates in the developed world. The bulk of the surge can be traced back to two sources: a local Lions Club International gathering and tea houses in a Taipei red light district. The two clusters were at first thought to be unrelated until a former Lions Club president revealed he had visited one of the tea houses. The civic leader, nicknamed the Lion King by local media, had at least 115 contacts while potentially infectious, demonstrating just how vulnerable the island of 23 million was to a major outbreak. At the start of the pandemic, Taiwan imposed world-leading infection control measures, including invasive contact tracing, travel bans, mandatory quarantines. But it began to let down its guard last summer. Thousands gathered at concerts, baseball games, and religious festivals. Large meals and family gatherings became more common, and masks less. But why did Taiwan's COVID-19 protocols fail after holding out through the worst of COVID-19? Life will find its way out, says Dr. Chen Qianjian, an epidemiologist and former vice president of Taiwan. The majority of recent cases are of a more infectious variant of the virus that was first detected in the UK. Chen adds that the poorly ventilated red light tea houses, where older men keep company with hostesses and often move between establishments, provided fertile ground for the virus to spread. Lapses in Taiwan's safety protocols are also to blame. The outbreak appears to have started at a hotel where quarantined flight crews stayed in the same building with non-quarantined guests. Authorities also reduced quarantine for cargo crews from 5 days to just 3. Compounding the problem, Taiwan badly lags in vaccinations, with less than 2% of the population getting a shot, thanks to both low demand and poor supply. The good news is Taiwan appears to be benefiting from COVID-19 transmission lessons that the rest of the world learned the hard way. The government swiftly opened testing centers in hot spots, restricted gatherings, and shut down schools. And many Taiwanese started staying home, even before the government stepped up restrictions. I know we're experiencing what happened abroad about a year ago, says Yachu Chuang, 28, from New Taipei City. As long as we all do what we can and follow the instructions, we will be able to overcome this crisis. And that reporting was by Michael Zenny and Gladys Tsai in Taipei. The brief news includes also 3 very short items under the news ticker. Leaders spar amid Samoan election crisis. After a tight election in April, Samoa's incumbent government blocked a transition of power to Prime Minister-elect Fiamme Naomi Mataafa, who took the oath of office in a tent outside the locked parliament May 24. Mataafa would be the Pacific nation's first female leader. Texas poised to loosen handgun laws. State lawmakers passed legislation May 24 that would allow Texans to carry a handgun without a background check, license, or required training. Governor Greg Abbott has said he will sign the bill into law, despite warnings from gun safety advocates and law enforcement groups that it poses risks to police and public safety. Ultramarathon runners die in storm. 21 people died May 22 after extreme weather, including hail, freezing rain, and high winds, hit a cross-country mountain ultramarathon race in northern China. More than 1,200 rescuers were deployed as part of recovery operations, state media said, as anger mounted on social media over the events. Planning. Under the heading Nation, the Balancing Act, can Alejandro Mayorkas create a more humane law enforcement agency? by Brian Bennett and Alana Abramson, with photographs by Natalie Kesar for Time. Alejandro is spelled A-L-E-J-A-N-D-R-O, Mayorkas, M-A-Y-O-R-K-A-S. It was around 4 a.m. April 28 when Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas jolted himself awake. As he lay in the dark, his mind locked onto the decision he'd made the day before to limit the Trump-era practice of arresting and deporting undocumented immigrants who show up at local courthouses for legal proceedings. Unable to sleep, he got out of bed, fired off an email about the politically sensitive move, then turned to the next conundrum. In the dark, he scanned the most recent data on how long unaccompanied minors were spending in Border Patrol custody, one of several onerous issues awaiting him in the day ahead. There are times when I try to go back to bed, and there are times when I realize it's not going to work, Mayorkas says, 3.5 hours later over engine noise of a Coast Guard Gulfstream jet heading from Washington, D.C., to New York City's LaGuardia Airport for a day of meetings. This morning, it wasn't going to work. A veteran federal prosecutor and top immigration official, Mayorkas has handled ethically fraught law enforcement issues for most of his adult life. But this is a new kind of pressure. He inherited the mess left by the Trump administration's anti-immigrant crusade. An estimated 1,000 children still separated from their families, 395,000 refugees waiting for word on their asylum requests, and a massive backlog of 1 million citizenship applications unprocessed. Here is a full-page photograph. It appears to be a portrait sitting, it is a photograph, of Mayorkas, Alejandro Mayorkas. He is seated on a stool. He's dressed in a dark suit. It's either black or very dark navy blue. A white shirt and a dark red, almost maroon tie. He has his hands folded on his lap. He's wearing a gold wedding band and a black watch with a black band. The cuffs of his white shirt are visible. On his left lapel, he wears a quite small pin of the U.S. flag. He is looking askance from the camera lens, and the background is a mottled gray to complement the dark suit and white shirt. He has very little hair. I would not say he's bald because I see some very, very short tufts of gray hair on a short haircut. He has darker, grayish, bushier eyebrows. And I would say his eyes are blue-gray, again, a complement to that grayish background. He is not actually smiling, nor is he not smiling. He has a rather neutral-looking, almost smile on his very clean-shaven face. Returning now to the text. At the same time, he faces a surge of new border crossers. The number of migrants trying to come to the U.S. has increased over 70% since President Biden took office and has reached a two-decade high. Then there's the continued business of enforcing the law, whether by cracking down on illegal immigration or deporting convicted criminals who have managed to slip in. Immigration's just one of the difficult topics under his remit. The Department of Homeland Security, DHS, was created after 9/11 by consolidating 22 federal agencies to prevent another terrorist attack, and running that conglomerate of bureaucracies has proved infamously unwieldy ever since. The third largest department in the federal government is charged with keeping bombs off planes, patrolling America's waterways, staffing border checkpoints, protecting the president, responding to natural disasters, ensuring U.S. elections are not hacked, and helping businesses defend against cyber attacks like the one May 7 that temporarily shut down a pipeline that provides 45% of the East Coast's fuel. Doing all that amid the pandemic in the aftermath of the deadly January 6 insurrection at the Capitol is going to be an awful lot like juggling flaming torches, says Michael Chertoff, who headed the department from 2005 to 2009 under George W. Bush and supports Mayorkas' moves so far. Biden's opponents are not making it any easier. The administration's current approach sends a message to Central Americans that you can get in, says Mark Krikorian, head of the Center for Immigration Studies, a think tank that pushes for reducing legal immigration. Describing that as humane, as the administration has, is tendentious, Krikorian says. Polling suggests it is a hard issue for the Biden team, with more than half of Americans disapproving of his handling of the influx of migrants at the border. Republican strategists have been quick to capitalize on that, and GOP lawmakers travel to the border to draw attention to the issue. Mayorkas' backers see him as the best candidate to help Biden achieve his goal of managing a broken immigration system through a mix of empathy and law enforcement. Mayorkas is the first immigrant and Latino to head the department and brings his lived experience as a Cuban refugee and son of a Holocaust survivor to the rollback of Donald Trump's most controversial policies. But DHS is still a law enforcement agency at its core, and Biden picked him not for his personal history, but because of his reputation for being a tough prosecutor, a senior White House official and former top transition advisor tell Time. How Mayorkas strikes the balance will define much about how the world sees America and America sees itself in the post-Trump moment. After the jet lands at LaGuardia, Mayorkas gets into a waiting SUV and heads across town to Lincoln Center, where 39 people from 21 different countries are waiting to take their oaths to become new citizens. For Mayorkas, presiding over naturalization ceremonies like this one is personal. Born in Havana, less than a year after Fidel Castro's communist takeover, Mayorkas was already a refugee by his first birthday. His father, Charles, a gregarious Cuban whose parents were Turkish and Polish transplants, owned a steel wool factory and expected to lose it in Castro's imminent nationalization of businesses. On August 21, 1960, he and his wife, Anita, took a Pan American Airlines flight to Miami with nine-month-old Ollie, as he's known by friends and colleagues, and his three-year-old sister, Kathy, part of a wave of nearly 250,000 Cubans who sought shelter in the U.S. from 1959 to 1962. For Mayorkas' mother, it was her second time becoming a refugee. As fascism spread through Europe in the late 1930s, Anita and her parents escaped Romania for southern France. With Vichy France collaborating with the Nazis, they were blocked from escaping to the U.S. The family does not know the exact details, but at that time visas were hard to come by, and immigrants had to prove they had enough money not to become a public charge or financial drain on the government. Anita and her parents sailed to Cuba on one of the last ships that escaping Jews were allowed to board, leaving France in 1941. The Nazis murdered her grandparents and several uncles left behind in Europe. From Cuba, Mayorkas' family eventually settled in Beverly Hills, California, where their lives were not particularly glamorous. Majorca's father was a workaholic, and his sister Kathy getting up at an ungodly hour to work at home before his job as a bookkeeper at a textile business, then staying up late to do the same. His mother, who spoke precise English in a lilting Romanian accent, became a teacher. Majorcas graduated from Beverly Hills High School in 1977 and UC Berkeley in 1981, before earning his degree at Loyola Law School in 1985. After law school, he was drawn to public service as a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles. "It was an ethic instilled in me by my parents," Majorcas tells Time, during an interview at DHS headquarters across the Anacostia River from the Capitol. "And also, quite frankly, my family's life history drove me to that." Majorcas' ascent has not been without controversy. After President Obama nominated him to lead the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS, in 2009, whistleblowers inside the agency alleged he had fast-tracked visas for projects associated with former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, and Hillary Clinton's brother Tony Rodham. In 2015, the department's inspector general found no explicit evidence of wrongdoing, but said Majorca's actions created an appearance of favoritism and special access. Majorca denied the allegations. In February, he was confirmed as secretary on a 56-43 Senate vote, one of the closest of Biden's cabinet. As he made his way across town in his SUV to the naturalization ceremony, Majorcas revisited some of the hard calls he's made over the years. He described the politically risky decision to cut $160 million from the operation costs of the Immigration Service in 2010 to help avoid raising citizenship application fees from $680 to $727. The thinness of an immigration family's budget, a visceral memory of his own youth. Arriving minutes later at Lincoln Center, he walked across the plaza into a small auditorium, where he strikes up conversations with several dozen immigrants about to become citizens. You will find, if you have not already, that this is indeed a country of tremendous opportunity, Majorcas says, but sometimes we do not live up to our highest ideals. Here's another photo, and I'll read the caption first. Majorcas is escorted from the Brooklyn Navy Yard to LaGuardia Airport by the Coast Guard during his trip to New York City, April 28. Well, he's definitely on a boat, and the boat is definitely on water, gray-looking water, with the horizon in the close distance, also gray. He's pointing at something off the boat, and each person in the photograph, of which there are four, is wearing an orange life jacket. All are wearing masks. Directly behind Secretary Majorcas are two members of the lifeguard, because they're in blue uniforms with caps that read U.S. Coast Guard. And I think it says Victor, or maybe it's Sector, New York. I can definitely read the New York, but I'm not sure if it says Victor or Sector. And then there's another woman alongside the Coast Guard man and woman, and she's wearing khaki pants and a blue tank top, so I think she is not part of that military service. Returning now to the text. When Majorcas moved into his office at DHS headquarters in early February, he placed a photo of his dad on his desk. Frozen in the middle of an uproarious laugh at an outdoor party, a jubilant mood he never remembers seeing in his father when he was growing up. "He worked so unbelievably hard," Majorcas says. "He also stood on principle. He was just straight to a fault," Majorcas says. "I remember my mom saying, 'Do you have to tell your boss you don't like his idea every time you don't like his idea?'" One of Majorca's first Law and Order steps has been getting his own house in order. In March, he dismissed the department's entire advisory council, concluding some of its members were there to advance political agendas rather than offer policy expertise. He followed Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's lead in launching an internal investigation into domestic extremism within his own department. Other than reading about reports of social media profiles, he says he has no greater information than what is in the public domain about this threat, but he says he has an obligation to ensure we do not have violent extremists within our ranks. May 11, the department announced it was forming a Center for Prevention Programs and Partnerships to further target domestic extremism. Mayorkas' inclination toward enforcement is showing up in some of his policy decisions as well. After Lincoln Center, his next stop was a one-and-a-half-hour meeting with a dozen or so immigration attorneys and community leaders about how he can improve the treatment of people facing deportation. Mayorkas has asked for a complete overhaul of the guidelines used by immigration and customs enforcement officers to determine whom to arrest and whom to deport. Several activists argued forcefully that immigration agents should not consider criminal convictions when deciding whom to deport, given the stark racial disparities in American policing. Mayorkas listened to the advice, but afterward remained skeptical of the calls for a blanket pass on criminal histories. I have a fundamental disagreement with some of their idealism, Mayorkas says, of the advocates pushing for a broader overhaul. They're talking about a system that's not grounded in the law. One individual whose deportation case he recently reviewed entered the U.S. illegally as an adult and has multiple felony sex offense convictions. Not to deport that person, Mayorkas says, would be a complete abdication. If some dislike his prosecutor's instincts, however, others are more concerned about his humanitarian streak. One of the first Trump-era rules Mayorkas revoked was the public charge rule. Like the restrictions that had kept so many refugees like his mother out of the country during the Holocaust, this rule linked immigration status with financial self-sufficiency. He's reunited at least four families separated at the border under Trump, though he declines to say when the rest of the 1,000 will be reunited. Breaking with the previous administration's default position that keeping refugees out of the country was better for national security, he designated both Venezuelans and Burmese for temporary protected status. Mayorkas told Time he was always in favor of allowing in up to 62,500 refugees, even when the White House initially kept the Trump-era level of 15,000 before raising it May 3. The hardest balancing act has been at the U.S.-Mexico border. Biden announced shortly after taking office that, unlike Trump, he would not expel children who arrived alone, but legally, unaccompanied minors can remain in federal detention facilities for only up to 72 hours before being transferred to the care of the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, where officials unite them with sponsors, usually relatives or foster families, while their cases are adjudicated. After Mayorkas was confirmed, he started to hear concerns from his staff that the border detention facilities were beyond capacity. Children were staying longer than 72 hours, and HHS's promises to find additional beds and outside shelters had not materialized. On a trip to the Rio Grande Valley March 6, Mayorkas concluded HHS needed help, and pressed by Biden in an Oval Office meeting 4 days later, promised to speed up the system. Within a week, he had directed FEMA to set up over a dozen emergency shelters for HHS that could house up to thousands of children. He deployed over 300 immigration staff to assist HHS with virtual case management to unite children with their sponsors and activated DHS's volunteer force to help children in shelters. But by late March, images leaked of children lying on mattresses on the floor, under blankets resembling tinfoil, in detention centers, causing an outcry. Immigration advocates lamented the crowded, appalling conditions. Republican critics allege the Biden administration's decision to allow minors to stay in the U.S. had caused more children to come, and that the White House was unprepared to deal with it. Mayorkas allies say it would have been much worse without the steps he took. The number of unaccompanied migrant children crossing the border decreased by 12% from March to April, Customs and Border Protection, CBP, figures show. The number of children in Border Patrol detention facilities has also decreased from 5,700 at the end of March to under 800 as of May 6, according to administration officials. And these children now spend approximately 24 hours there on average, down from 139 at the beginning of April. If it were not for him driving this, we'd still be looking at lines of kids in Border Patrol custody, in HHS custody, a White House official says. Another photo here to share. This is a photo of a small auditorium. I don't know, maybe there are a couple of hundred seats. And everything is in neutral colors. The walls are in neutral colors, the ceiling, the chairs, the auditorium seating. And it's not quite filled because obviously social distancing has been implemented, because every two or three or five or six seats is occupied by one or two people. I don't see any children in the auditorium. There are other people, perhaps press members, on the edges of the auditorium, not seated. And in fact, none of the people is seated at this moment in which the photo was taken, because they're standing with their right hands raised. All are masked except for the person at the podium, who is Mayorkas. And he's presiding over a naturalization ceremony held at Lincoln Center in New York City, April 28. Now, returning to the text. Mayorkas admits these are temporary solutions that do not tackle the underlying problems. Even some Biden allies on the Hill are critical. Trump overdid it, separating kids from families, says Representative Henry Cuellar, a Democrat who represents parts of the Rio Grande Valley. They're trying to be humane at the border, but the pendulum has swung too much from the crazy stuff Trump did to another one, where being humane means let's not enforce the law in many ways. DHS officials say they are following the law. Republicans are even more critical, alleging Mayorkas' systematic rollback of Trump's policies incentivizes illegal immigration, saying it both endangers migrants who've paid huge fees to smugglers to make the dangerous trek and compromises national security by allowing criminals to slip in. Earlier this year, CBP apprehended two Yemeni men crossing the border whose names appeared on a federal terrorism watch list. Indiana Senator Todd Young, the top Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee on Counterterrorism, has repeatedly prodded Mayorkas for more information about the threat posed by illegal entries that he says Mayorkas has not provided. Incidents like this remind us that a functionally open border poses a national security threat to the United States, Young wrote to Mayorkas in May. And a final photo here, just at the end of this article. It is Secretary Mayorkas again, in what I think now really is a very dark blue suit. And he is fist bumping a lineup of vaccination site workers. To me, they look like they're dressed in the camouflage uniforms of perhaps the National Guard, or the Army. They're in the khaki and tan colors, but I don't see any insignia or any other identification. The caption simply reads, later that day, Mayorkas visits a FEMA mass vaccination site at Medgar Evers College in Brooklyn. Returning to the text, just after 2 p.m. on Mayorkas Day in New York, the Homeland Security Secretary decided it was time for lunch. The skyscrapers of Manhattan fell back as his black SUV drove across the Williamsburg Bridge to a popular Venezuelan arepas bar on Grand Street in Brooklyn. Tucking into a takeout box of green plantains, rice, and seared tilapia, Mayorkas spoke of his parents. If his dad was stoic, his mother was relentlessly positive, an incredibly optimistic person, his sister says, despite her family's loss in the Holocaust. My mom, Mayorkas says, given what she went through, was every day's a new one. Something beautiful can happen. Something tragic can happen. But every day's a new life, and therefore we have an obligation to be better today than we were yesterday, and tomorrow than we are today. That was her. Mayorkas keeps a photo of her near the one of his jubilant, laughing father at his desk in Anacostia, a reminder of her values. As he talks through the hard calls ahead, Mayorkas says that in the end, his mother's philosophy is more deeply ingrained in how he wants to see the world and run DHS. I would tell people around the leadership table, I am more of my mother's son in that regard than my father's, he says. This article, again called The Balancing Act, was written by Brian Bennett and Alana Abramson, with reporting by Mariah Espada, Washington. I'm Done Trying to Make You See My Humanity, by Nicole Chung, Chung. As we continue to witness violence against Asian Americans, including in the past month the punching of a Bay Area father pushing his baby in a stroller, the assault on two women with a cement block in a Baltimore liquor store, and the stabbing of two women, ages 85 and 65, at a bus stop in San Francisco, my social media feeds are frequently filled with messages imploring people to recognize and challenge anti-Asian racism. It's clear why, as many are apparently unaware. A recent survey found that 37% of white Americans had not even heard about the spike in attacks on Asian Americans, with 42% of respondents unable to name a single prominent Asian American. Another survey revealed that Asian women were treated in 65% of incidents in which the victim's gender was reported. Asian women were targeted in 65% of incidents in which the victim's gender was reported. And when demographic information was available, a majority of perpetrators were reported to be white and male. The recent wave of harassment and violence is just one manifestation of a deep-rooted anti-Asian prejudice in this country, which cannot be understood solely in terms of individual incidents or without acknowledging that it is inextricably bound up with America's long legacy of racial oppression built on anti-blackness. But while discrimination faced by Asian and Pacific Islander people, especially those more vulnerable because of poverty, immigration status, occupation, age, isolation or other circumstances, is far from new, sometimes it can feel as though we're begging others to see it, see us, at all. Over the past year, I've often found myself urging family, friends, acquaintances, and strangers to first notice and then feel outraged by the ways in which Asian and Pacific Islander Americans are being endangered by pandemic scapegoating, from children being tormented at school to elders being attacked in the streets. As a Korean adoptee raised in a white family, I've also spent years attempting to translate and explain my own experience, including the bigotry and racialized misogyny I regularly encounter as an East Asian American woman to many of the people who love me most. I understand and have joined in calls to action. appeals to would-be allies. I've been frustrated by white silence. None of us should be unwilling to name or condemn racist violence. But as the attacks continue, I find I'm increasingly weary of pleading for acknowledgement or empathy. I'm ready to stop chasing after those who need to see your deepest wounds on display before they'll even contemplate believing your words. I've lost the energy or desire to educate or provide reasoned, patient answers to anyone who still needs to be convinced Asian people face discrimination and violence in this country. Even the week of the Atlanta area spa shootings that left 8 people, 6 of them Asian women, dead, I received many versions of the question, what would you say to white people in this moment to help them understand how serious this is? What can I say to persuade this or that group of white people, white parents, white people with Asian relatives or friends or coworkers, white people who aren't comfortable talking about race or privilege, to start having these important conversations if they are not already? Is it my responsibility to do so? Maybe, if I can, but the truth is that I'm tired of being asked to think about racism from the perspective of those least impacted by it. I do not always feel like explaining anti-Asian prejudice to people who've never considered it before. I do not want to hear or validate confessions that someone has not thought enough, done enough, said enough, worked enough, read enough, challenged enough microaggressions at work or school. I do not need an inbox full of emotional labor from white people just discovering the fact that Asians in America experience racism and that I'm Asian American. I do hope more people read, learn, and speak out, as we should all be doing, and I am grateful to those who have more drive and capacity to teach right now. But there are days when I feel up to it and days when I do not, and lately, the latter outnumber the former. Perhaps it shouldn't have taken me so long to realize that it is not always my responsibility to engage with white people on this issue. Whether that means cataloging the most recent horrific attacks, in case someone's still unaware, providing examples of racism I've personally experienced in diverse and insular spaces alike, recommending articles and books for them to read, offering impromptu lessons on the Asian American history many of us were not taught in school, or trying to put words to the heavy dread and fury I carry through each day now, all in an effort to persuade others to name and care about what's happening. Laying down this burden flies against an instinct first cultivated so I could cope with and try to close the empathy gap between me and the white family and friends who loved me, but who could never quite see or grasp my reality as a Korean-American woman. As a transracial adoptee, I was uniquely conditioned to excuse and instruct or even comfort the white people who adopted me, or hired me, or gave me a chance, or just seemed to tolerate my presence. I felt as though I should be the one to not just reach out, but stretch more than halfway to meet them. It was my duty, I long believed, to be a bridge, even if this sometimes required me to offer up my pain or trauma for others to walk over in pursuit of some elusive understanding. Racism against Asian and Pacific Islander people in this country is long-standing, but perhaps I could permit myself to feel the full weight of my anger and weariness over it only when, after a year filled with so much grief and fear and the loss of several people I loved, I found myself buying safety whistles for me and my daughters. Now, as each week brings new reports of Asian elders being assaulted, Asian women being harassed, Asian children being bullied, I realize how little will I have to partake in discussions about racism that center and cater to whiteness, that white people don't know, what they're uncomfortable with, what they refuse to see or recognize or speak out against. There will always be those who doubt or deny racism, othering, and fetishization that dehumanizes us, the violence that threatens us. At what cost, I wonder, do I continue to exhaust my own finite resources, running after them, hoping to reach them? Have I not lost enough precious time and energy to white supremacy? After the Atlanta shootings, when a fellow Korean American texted to ask how we might try to talk with, protect, and support our families in the midst of our shared rage and grief, I realized the conversations I most want to have right now are ones that focus not on the silent or the unconvinced, but on the people we fight for. Our loved ones, our communities, our allies, those to whom we owe our solidarity. As I think about what I can do, how I can best help and hold space for those more vulnerable than myself, I have found the most meaningful support and comfort within the community I do have, and have had all along, the people who do not need to hear my pleas in order to see and value my humanity. Nicole Chung, author of the article, is author of All You Can Ever Know. The next article, which may be abridged for time purposes, is under the headline Business, the Great Reopening. The workplace doesn't work. Now's our chance to reinvent it. And Lippman, Joanne Lippman, is author of That's What She Said and a former editor-in-chief of USA Today. Her next book is on the art and science of reinvention. Until March 2020, Carrie and Britt Altizer of Richmond, Virginia, put in long hours at work. She in life insurance sales, and he as a restaurant manager to support their young family. Their lives were frenetic, their schedules controlled by their jobs. Then the pandemic shutdown hit, and they, like millions of others, found their world upended. Britt was briefly furloughed. Carrie, 31, had to quit to take care of their infant son. A native of Peru, she hoped to find remote work as a Spanish translator. When that didn't pan out, she took a part-time sales job with a cleaning service that allowed her to take her son to the office. But as the baby grew into a toddler, that wasn't feasible either. Meanwhile, the furlough prompted her husband, 30, to reassess his own career. I did some soul searching. During the time I was home, I was gardening and really loving life, says Britt, who grew up on a farm and studied environmental science in college. I realized working outdoors was something I had to get back to doing. Today, both have quit their old jobs and made a sharp pivot. They opened a landscaping business together. We're taking a leap of faith, Carrie says, after realizing the pre-pandemic way of working simply does not make sense anymore. Now they have control over their schedules, and her mom has moved nearby to care for their son. I love what I'm doing. I'm closer to my goal of, I get to go to work, I don't have to go to work, Carrie says. We aren't supposed to live to work, we're supposed to work to live. As the post-pandemic great reopening unfolds, millions of others are also reassessing their relationship to their jobs. The modern office was created after World War II on a military model. Strict hierarchies created by men for men, with an assumption that there's a wife to handle duties at home. But after years of gradual change in Silicon Valley and elsewhere, there's a growing realization the model is broken. Millions of people have spent the past year reevaluating their priorities. How much time do they want to spend in an office? Where do they want to live if they can work remotely? Do they want to switch careers? For many, this has become a moment to literally redefine what is work. More fundamentally, the pandemic has masked a deep unhappiness that a startling number of Americans have with the workplace. During the first stressful months of quarantine, job turnover plunged. People were just hoping to hang on to what they had, even if they hated their jobs. For many more millions of essential workers, there was never a choice but to keep showing up at stores, on deliveries in factories, often at great risk to themselves, with food and agricultural workers facing a higher chance of death on the job. But now millions of white-collar professionals and office workers appear poised to jump. Anthony Klotz, an associate professor of management at Texas A&M University, set off a Twitter storm by predicting, "The Great Resignation is coming." But those conversations miss a much more consequential point. The true significance is not what we're leaving, it's what we're going toward. In a surprising phenomena, people are not just abandoning jobs, but switching professions. This is a radical reassessment of our careers, a great reset in how we think about work. A Pew survey in January found 66% of unemployed people have seriously considered changing occupations. And significantly, that phenomena is common to those at every income level, not just the privileged high earners. A third of those surveyed have started taking courses or job retraining. Pew does not have comparable earlier data, but in a 2016 survey, about 80% of people reported being somewhat or very satisfied with their jobs. Early on in the pandemic, Lucy Chang Evans, a 48-year-old Naperville, Illinois civil engineer, quit her job to help her three kids with remote learning while pursuing an online MBA. Becoming a lot more introspective, she realized she's done with toxic workplaces. "I feel like I'm not willing to put up with abusive behavior at work anymore." She also plans to pivot into a more meaningful career, focused on tackling climate change. The deep unhappiness with jobs points to a larger problem in how workplaces are structured. The line between work and home has been blurring for decades, and with the pandemic, obliterated completely for many of us, as we've been literally living at work. Meanwhile, the stark divide between white-collar workers and those with hourly on-site jobs, grocery clerks, bus drivers, delivery people, became painfully visible. During the pandemic, nearly half of all employees with advanced degrees were working remotely, while more than 90% of those with a high school diploma or less had to show up in person, CoStar found. Business leaders are as confused as the rest of us, perhaps more so, when it comes to navigating the multiple demands and expectations of the new workplace. Consider their conflicting approaches to remote work. Tech firms, including Twitter, Dropbox, Shopify, and Reddit, are all allowing employees the option to work at home permanently, while oil company Phillips 66 brought back most staff to its Houston headquarters almost a year ago. Target and Walmart have both allowed corporate staff to work remotely, while low-paid workers face potential COVID-19 exposure on store floors. In the financial industry, titans like Blackstone, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs expect employees to be back on site this summer. J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon recently declared that remote work doesn't work for those who want to hustle. It doesn't work in terms of spontaneous idea generation. And, you know, people don't like commuting, but so what? There is a real risk that office culture could devolve into a class system, with on-site employees favored over remote workers. WeWork CEO Sandeep Mathrani recently insisted the least engaged are very comfortable working from home, a stunning indictment that discounts working parents everywhere and suggests that those who might need flexibility, like those caring for relatives, could not possibly be ambitious. Mathrani's comments are yet another reminder the pandemic shutdown has been devastating for women, throwing into high relief just how inhospitable and precarious the workplace can be for caretakers. Faced with the impossible task of handling the majority of childcare and homeschooling, 4.2 million women dropped out of the labor force from February 2020 to April 2020, and nearly 2 million still have not returned. Oxfam calculates women globally lost a breathtaking $800 billion in income in 2020. Women's progress in terms of U.S. workforce participation has been set back by more than three decades. Despite Mathrani's assertion, there is little evidence that remote employees are less engaged. There is, however, plenty of evidence that we're actually working more. A study by Harvard Business School found that people were working on average 48 minutes more per day after the lockdown started. A new research paper from the University of Chicago and University of Essex found remote workers upped their hours by 30%, yet did not increase productivity. All this comes at a moment when business and culture have never been more intertwined. As work has taken over people's lives and Americans are doing less together outside the office, more and more of people's political beliefs and social life are defining the office. In thousands of Zoom meetings over the past year, employees have demanded their leaders take on systemic racism, sexism, transgender rights, gun control, and more. People have increasingly outsized expectations of their employers. This year, business surpassed nonprofits to become the most trusted institution globally, according to the Edelman Trust Barometer, and people are looking to business to take an active role tackling racism, climate change, and misinformation. Moving now to the end of this article, some of the shortcomings of remote work, the lack of camaraderie and mentoring, the fear of being forgotten, may ultimately be bridged by new technology. Google and Microsoft are already starting to integrate prominent remote video conferencing capabilities more fully into meeting spaces, so remote workers don't seem like an afterthought. Augmented reality, which so far has been used most notably for games like Pokemon Go, could end up transforming into a useful work tool, allowing remote workers to seem to be in the room with on-site workers. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.